This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. I am sitting here at NDC speaking with Steve Sanderson.
Either's fine with me.
Either's fine, great. And so I caught the tail end of your talk yesterday. It was fascinating. You were talking about future JavaScript features or browser features.
That is right. I was trying to predict the future of client-side web application development. So don't know how accurate my predictions will be, but some of them are fairly safe bets, like we're going to start using ES 2015, 2016 stuff pretty soon, and then there's a whole raft of other features coming towards us.
So you saw, that was actually the first time I've seen ES 2015 and 2016. Yeah. I think I'd heard in the past ES 6 and 7.
Yeah, so it's just a bit of new marketing, really. The folks behind the standards there have basically committed to bringing out a new update every year. So we've got this annual cycle rather than, you know, up until now it's been kind of every 5 years or every 10 years in one case. So given that it's going to be annual, it sort of makes sense to give the name a year.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Kind of like Visual Studio's done. Yeah, right?
Exactly.
So what are some great features there, 2015, 2016?
Yeah, okay. So ES 2015, which was previously known as ES 6, is got to be the biggest set of changes that have come in JavaScript since it was first introduced. If you look at something that's written with ES 2015 syntax, if you've never seen that syntax before, you would probably not even guess it was JavaScript. It looks really different. So you've got import statements, which give you a clean alternative to having loads of script tags. You've got actual classes, which are the same at runtime as regular JavaScript prototypical inheritance, but it gives you a nice syntax for declaring that you can remember.
Okay, we're finally taking advantage. A class has been a reserve word in JavaScript forever, right?
I think that might be
maybe
the case.
Maybe, I don't know. Yeah. Can I start using those features? Can I, like, I know there's some, like, polyfills or transpilers or whatever.
Yeah, I'd say if you want to start using ES 2015 today, it's really not as difficult as you might think. So assuming that you want to target all browsers since, let's say, IE9, then you can basically use almost all of the ES 2015's features. You just need to use a transpiler. And the one that everybody seems to be most into at the moment is called Babel, or some people call it Babel. I don't know what the right pronunciation is.
Okay.
But anyway, that's an open source project that will take your ES 2015 code and produce an ES5 equivalent of it. And it's really fast. It's very easy to set up. And to be honest with you, I can't think of any good reason not to be doing that. Like, if you're not doing that, you're sort of just keeping yourself in the past, really.
Okay.
Because this thing is a fully ratified standard now. We know this thing is definitely landing. All the browser makers are committed to bringing this in. There isn't really a good reason to not be using this today.
So I've looked at using TypeScript for that kind of class support in the past. Is there any kind of downside to continuing with that, or are they similar?
No, there's certainly no downside to that. If you're getting benefit out of TypeScript, then absolutely TypeScript, in a way, is a transpiler because it is taking some syntax that is a lot like ES 2015. It just adds some additional features on top of that to do with strong typing.
Great.
So if you're getting some benefit out of that strong typing, then, yeah, definitely use TypeScript. On the other hand, if you don't want to use the strong typing, then you'll find that something like Babel will do the compilation like an order of magnitude faster.
Okay. So that's a kind of a no-brainer as far as a feature to dig into. What else did you talk about that was a little more forward-looking?
Well, I was also looking at web components, which is sort of all tied up with ES 2015. You know, it's kind of a part of this package of things that's arriving at the moment. But unlike that, making that work across all browsers is not quite as guaranteed today. Mm-hmm. So the best-known polyfill for web components is Polymer.js, but in terms of IE, that's only IE 11 onwards. But it's a really good feature. So web components is a way of combining together a bunch of scripts and markup and styles to make a kind of reusable package of UI features that you can put in your application. And you can assign them to a custom element name. So you can have something like sales-chart as an element, and when that goes into your application, your custom sales chart appears, and it has all the behaviors that you want. And it can be, to some extent, encapsulated from the rest of your page as well. So this is a feature called Shadow DOM, and it's a way of telling the browser that a certain element should be abstracted away as far as the page that contains it is concerned. So code running outside it won't see the elements inside. If, for example, you were using jQuery and you had a selector and it happened to match something inside that component, it won't actually match it because it's considered to be like a separate document.
Okay.
So you don't get accidental leakages of behavior into your component or out of it.
Got it.
And so it just makes reuse easier.
And same for style sheets as well.
Yeah, that's right. If you bring a style sheet into your web component, it's only going to apply inside that shadow DOM root. It won't apply outside it.
Okay. And I believe you mentioned Polymer.
Yes.
It's the polyfill for that.
Yeah, it's the best known polyfill, but Polymer is only a way of doing something like web components. If you're going to use something like React or Knockout or Angular or any of those kind of things, they've all got their own kind of concept of reusable components with custom elements. So if you're using any of those things, you probably can pretty much do this anyway in a fairly cross-browser way.
Right. Okay. So then what other features did you cover?
Well, I was interested in the upcoming await async support. I think that's
always been kind of a challenge in JavaScript.
Isn't it? Yeah. So JavaScript for a long time was plagued by this sort of everyone's got slightly different way of doing callbacks thing, which is quite troublesome. And then it all got formalized around promises. And promises is a fantastically elegant concept that gives you a really clear way of working with callbacks and chaining them and combining them and so on. So promises are brilliant, and they're now a native browser feature, but there's still a lot of opportunity to get confused with promises because there's so many ways you can chain them together and not necessarily even understand how success and error values are flowing through that chain that you can still get things wrong by mistake. And I find this happens all the time in my work, like, not me, of course, but other programmers get very confused.
Right.
Or I might do sometimes. Whereas with, as any C-sharp programmer knows, the await and async keywords, you can write your code as if it was synchronous.
It's so obvious and what's going to happen.
You can't get that wrong, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's part of the ES 2016 proposal. And if you want to do that today, you can either use Babel, which will transpile async away just directly, or you can use the generators feature, which is in ES 2015. Slightly different syntax, but it gives you the ability to do something almost exactly the same.
Okay. Can you explain generators a bit?
Yeah, so a generator for a C-sharp programmer is exactly like the yield keyword that came in with C-sharp 2. So you can have a function that returns an infinite number of values. Like every time that you ask it for the next value, it'll give you the next thing, and it'll never stop doing that. So that's yield in C-sharp. And generators in ES 2015 do the same thing. So you can have a function, and you put a little asterisk after the keyword function to say that it's a generator. And then inside there, you can have yield return whatever. You can do that inside a while true loop or something like that. And then the thing that calls it will receive each of these values.
So then do I just throw away promises now that I've got?
So, no, you still need to use promises. So the way that you can use this to make promises feel synchronous is by having some other code that invokes your generator and gets back the sequence of values. And each time it gets back a value, it will say, well, what kind of thing is this? If it's a promise, then I'm going to wait for that promise to complete before I ask you for the next value. And so if you are yielding a series of promises, in effect, it's like your promises are being called sequentially one after the other, which is why your code ends up looking synchronous.
Okay.
So it's not very easy to understand verbally, but when you see that written down, it's really quite straightforward and nice.
Okay. So then there was mscripten?
Yeah, that's right. So just yesterday or the day before, depending on time zones, there was an announcement from Brendan Eich that there's going to be a new bytecode format coming to the web. So instead of JavaScript just being expressed in plain text, as it always has been, it'll be possible to describe your code in a binary format.
Okay.
And the idea with that really is just to take all of the good work that's been done with mscripten, which compiles native code to JavaScript, and AssemJS, which is a special subset of JavaScript that can be optimized very well, and say, okay, we don't need to write out AssemJS as legal JavaScript anymore. We can just write it out as binary code. And that saves the browser a lot of work in terms of parsing. The AssemJS is very fast at runtime, but it still imposes a higher parsing cost on the browser. And that's particularly noticeable on mobiles. where people complain that, say, a large game might take multiple seconds to start, during which this browser CPU is just like 100% parsing. So it would be nice to eliminate that cost altogether. Also, you get smaller use of network traffic because it's very, very compact.
Yeah.
And also, even though the semantics of WebAssembly are the same as ASM.js initially, mm-hmm. they are open to adding additional WebAssembly-only features in the future. So it might be possible to have new types of parallelism, for example, that's only possible in WebAssembly. If they decide that it would be inappropriate to have it in JavaScript, it might still be appropriate for there to be a low-level feature that other languages can compile down to.
Okay.
So yeah, that's all about performance, really.
Wow. Okay.
And you can kind of do it today. You know, we've got Emscripten today. You can compile pretty much arbitrary C code. You can get your ASM.js. It will be very, very fast in Firefox, which is the only browser that supports it today. Mm. But other browser makers have committed to implementing that too. I know IE certainly has. I don't know about all of them, but I'm pretty sure they don't really have a lot of choice these days.
Yeah.
That's useful for a lot of things. But one thing you can't really do very well with that today, but it's kind of promised in the future, is compile some other language that's not C or C++ into JavaScript. So theoretically you can do it, because Emscripten takes LLVM bytecode and turns that into JavaScript. So in theory, anything that compiles to LLVM bytecode can be translated into JavaScript. But in practice, it's much more complicated than that. So if you take a Swift application, for instance, and that uses the whole Clang LLVM toolchain, mm-hmm. it will produce LLVM bytecode, and you might be able to get Emscripten to produce some JavaScript, but it's not going to run because you won't have the Swift runtime there in JavaScript.
Okay.
And it's the same with Go and Rust and so on. And in certain cases, people have managed to get little bits of experimental code working, but really, it's not a realistic option today. But in the future, it's quite likely with WebAssembly that there'll be a strong reason for the makers of these other compilers to want to support WebAssembly.
Okay. And I believe you had tons of great demos during your talk. This was one where you said it was basically very difficult to get a demo working for. Was that one, or was it...
Okay, so I gave a demo of compiling SQLite, the embedded database, into JavaScript, which is absolutely trivial. It works flawlessly, and you need to do nothing clever at all.
Okay.
But SQLite is just written with C, so it's kind of the best case, very, very easy thing to get working. The thing I struggled with was, I did try and compile some Swift and some Go and some Rust, and none of them would work. And
okay.
I tricked all the mailing lists, and nobody else can do it either.
Okay. Wow. So next, there was shared array buffer.
Yeah, shared array buffer. So one of the limitations that Emscripten faces today is that it can only use the features that are available to JavaScript, obviously, because it's running on a JavaScript virtual mm-hmm. machine. And that means that there are certain types of parallelism that you can't do, because JavaScript has always worked hard to be single-threaded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've got web workers with JavaScript, but they are deliberately limited. With a web worker, each of your workers is only allowed to access its own private memory space.
Okay.
And when you want to communicate between your application and those workers,
right.
you have to post these serialized messages to say what you want them to do, and they post a message back saying what they did. Mm-hmm. And that's cool, but it can't really approximate the performance of native code that will spin up multiple threads that all just mutate the same memory simultaneously without any complicated message passing. So shared array buffer provides a way to pass a reference to a block of memory where you're effectively saying, I opt into having no control over timings here. Like, I accept the fact that anybody can mutate my memory at any time with no guarantees. And when you opt into that for your shared array buffer, then you can get much higher performance in certain cases.
It's interesting. We were talking to Damian Edwards yesterday about some of the server work that they're doing, optimizing serving ASP.NET 5.
Oh, yeah.
And that was something they ran into on the server side, this kind of shared buffer and passing and the minimizing transitions and all that kind of stuff.
It's funny, isn't it? Because on one side of the industry, we've got the move towards functional programming and no shared state.
Right.
And then at the other end, you've got this need for exploiting all the cores of, like, many core processors with as a little amount of overhead as possible, where you do need to mutate shared state. And so we're kind of straddling these two competing goals there. And for certain applications, like, for example, high-performance games or something like that, the shared state parallelism is clearly winning. And other things like certain types of business applications, functional programming seems to deliver much higher benefits than
right.
that.
Okay. I remember one of the other ones that I was actually really excited about because I'd looked at before and meant to play with and hadn't yet was grid style sheets.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that's funny. So the first thing to know about grid style sheets is it's got nothing whatsoever to do with grids.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a company called The Grid, which, you know, is a cool name for a company, but it's a little confusing when you make a product called grid style sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the idea with grid style sheets is to kind of break free from all of the layout limitations of regular CSS. Now, any web developer in the world has struggled with making things get mm-hmm. vertically centered or shrink wrapping to their content, you know, that kind of thing. It's embarrassingly difficult for us, even when we can solve some of the hardest problems in the world. We can't make something get centered inside something else.
And it's like, funny because you feel like I could describe the problem.
Yeah.
I want this to be here and I want this to always be here, but never bigger than the
yeah.
parent or whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's exactly what grid style sheets does. So it's an example of a constraints-based layout engine. And with a constraints layout engine, you don't necessarily care so much about hierarchy and padding and things like that. You just make a rule that says something like, my pop-up menu needs to be left aligned with some other element,
mm-hmm.
and it needs to be vertically centered in a certain area, and it needs to be big enough for its content, that kind of thing. So it's
mm-hmm.
just a few constraints you give, and then the constraint solver will choose the appropriate position for it. And it's the same technique that's used in some modern iOS applications. They've got a technology called Auto Layout,
okay.
and that allows iOS to have things like, you've seen they've announced the Windows 8 style sidebar thing in iOS 9,
okay.
I think. And
oh,
know,
right, right.
So, yeah, well done, Apple. That's a good original idea, that one.
Exactly.
And the way that applications can fit into arbitrarily sized screens is by using technologies like Auto Layout, where the developer just specifies a set of constraints and the operating system positions things. And grid style sheets allows you to do precisely the same thing, but on the web.
Okay.
It's a cool, very cool technology. It's a bit experimental at this
mm-hmm.
stage. I don't know if too many people are really using it.
And it's JavaScript,
yeah.
right? So,
that's
I mean,
right.
it's I can start using
yeah.
it today.
Absolutely. I think the people building that would aspire to it one day maybe even being a native feature. So you have your style type equals text/GSS instead of CSS.
Okay.
And then, you know, you would have this alternate syntax for defining layout, which is a heck of a lot more expressive and straightforward than regular CSS in certain
mm-hmm.
cases. It's also got some really cool, powerful features that has got no equivalent in CSS. For example, well, a simple example is that it has variables. Now, of course, if you're using Sass or less, you know about variables, but these are cool variables. They don't just have a specific value. They have a value where you can define some rules. Like you can say, this variable is positive, this variable is less than 250, but you don't say what actual value it is.
Right.
The constraints optimizer will choose the value in order to satisfy all the other constraints. Also, it supports if-else conditions. So you could say something like, if this element is bigger than a certain size, then I want this layout, otherwise some other layout. Which is like media queries, but
mm-hmm.
you know media queries are limited to querying just the window width or some other
yeah.
basic thing like that. Whereas with GSS, you can query absolutely arbitrary things. And it's evaluated at runtime.
Mm-hmm.
So if you mutate the DOM over time, then it will update its layout accordingly.
One really nice feature I liked about it, too, is that it animated between.
Oh, yeah.
And so
yeah.
I watch as you would resize
yeah.
the window. Not only would it apply the constraints, but it would, like, really
yeah.
nicely, smoothly move
yeah.
to it.
So that's not actually a native GSS feature. I just put a CSS transition rule.
Oh, okay.
So it was just, like, transition star 1 second or something.
Smart. I like that.
So in an application where you want everything to just instantly snap to the correct position, you wouldn't have that rule.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite sweet, as you say, to see things sort of fluidly slide into their correct position.
Right.
Which is dead easy because GSS internally is using like position absolute or something for everything.
Okay.
So all your animations just work.
Now, because of things like that, it might be difficult to use some GSS and some traditional CSS
yeah,
together.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably true. Yeah. I think there's a lot of reasons why, if you are adopting this, you should expect to be in for a slightly bumpy ride.
Yeah.
Like you will definitely be one of the first adopters in the world if you pick this up today.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be the one who's actually figuring out what the best practices are,
right.
what stuff does and doesn't work that well. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I wasn't standing up there trying to advocate that everyone should take this on today, but if you've got a, you know, an interesting little side project and you want to try out some really cutting edge possible future thing, then yeah, it's a really fun thing to play with.
And one thing too, I was all excited about it and kind of sold on it, and you're like, you explained too that it can be difficult to debug. Like if something's not working, it's like it's actually solving a constraint, and you don't get that clear understanding of what did I do wrong.
I could imagine some future tooling that shows you visually how things have been anchored and laid out. But for at the moment, it's a bit like if you give it not quite enough information, it will just make some decision that might be completely bizarre, like it chooses to position an element off the screen or something like that. And it may not be obvious until you really think very carefully why it's done that.
Great. Well, this is fascinating. I'm looking forward to watching the video again and digging into some of this stuff. I understand you've got to run off and catch a plane.
Yes, that is true.
So thank you very much for your time.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
Great talking to you.
Cheers.